Hot Air is a co-production of American University Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
From the campus of American University in Washington, D.C., a collaboration between the American Bar Association's Energy, Markets, and Finance Committee and the Washington College of Law, this is the Hot Air Show, your source for insight, opinion, and news on everything energy and climate. Today, we have a lot of interesting stuff on the agenda. We're going to talk about the Paris Treaty. We're going to talk about the Supreme Court's stay of the Clean Power Plan. We're going to talk about the Supreme Court's decision in the Electric Power Supply Association case, and other musings. So let's get started by going around the table and having the panel introduce themselves.
Hi, Bill Snape. I am a practitioner in residence here at the Washington College of Law and senior counsel with the Center for Biological Diversity.
Toby Short, Government Affairs, Duke Energy.
Kevin Book, I head the research team at Clearview Energy Partners.
Jean Chemnick, I'm the international climate reporter for Environment and Energy Publishing.
Chiara Pappalardo, international research scholar and adjunct professor at WCL.
And I got to say, it's nice to have an international flavor to the Hot Air Show, and we're looking forward to some of those perspectives. And maybe we could start with you before we just suck it in to being all about America, as you know Americans do. What, from your view, was the take-home in the EU bloc from the Paris Treaty? Was it seen as much a success as some on this side of the Atlantic would like to trumpet it as? How did the non-binding aspect of it play?
Well, I think the EU has been championing the idea of having a binding agreement for quite some time. And I think it has certainly liked seeing the US making some good faith progress and effort in being at the table and trying to get others at the table, namely China. Certainly, we have to look at what the treaty says in terms of how much binding it is and what the obligations are. But I think Paris is perceived as a success from the EU. The other thing that I would like to add briefly is that it certainly is a pillar for the EU in terms of what the EU is trying to achieve from an energy perspective and transition into a low carbon economy. So we will see how this plays and how the US is going to, and China and everybody else is going to implement their pledges. But it certainly is, I think, a success.
Jean, what was your take? You were watching a lot of the kind of flow in the news on this as it was coming through. Did you feel that it was seen as something that held a lot of promise, or was it something that was going to be so difficult from an implementation perspective with the non-binding aspect? I'm curious. I've heard a lot of very good things and a lot of criticism about it, simply that, you know, countries make their pledges, they commit to kind of get to where they're going to get to on their own with their own mechanisms that they will design, mm-hmm. and then they come back and report, and everyone says, here's what we're going to do together. As someone remarked the other day, that sounds an awful like what we were already doing with the Framework Convention. What's your take?
Well, I mean, I think it was very important for sort of international morale in this area. Obviously, Copenhagen had fallen apart 6 years prior, and there was a lot of pessimism that the world would ever do anything. And this, at least, you know, was countries agreeing that this was something that was important to do. And one U.S. Member of the U.S. team came out of the room and sort of said, you know, this was really the best deal that we could possibly have gotten with the constraints that exist. A lot of those constraints are the U.S. Congress. But there are other countries also that had limitations on what they could really offer in terms of binding or non-binding. It keeps the process alive. There was sort of a hopeful message out of Paris. The question becomes, obviously they managed the message very well ahead of Paris to say that this is not going to get us where we need to go or even close to it, really. It's a little bit of an improvement, but it gets you to about 2.7 degrees, you know, over pre-industrial levels, and really you need at least 2, and the new goal is trying to get to 1.5, so you need to do a lot more later in the century. But this at least comes up with an aspirational target that eventually you would get to that kind of reduction.
You know, Kevin, I have a lot of faith in our kids and what they're going to be able to do later in the century.
They're going to be little solar dynamos. Chris, I think when we were here last, it was Bill who said that it was going to be success. And the question was, what would success mean? I'm going to turn that around. I'm sure Bill will come back to that. But I want to talk about what failure might look like. Because the thing that no one's supposed to talk about right now in Washington is what could go wrong. We're still in that sort of heady afterglow period where optimism and a sheer sense of joy at finally having had the international system work the way it was supposed to work in a distant echo of post-war multilateralism is really got everybody's very excited. Here's the thing. Every single time that something shakes the confidence of the international community, the narrative is going to grow stronger about failure. Here's what we had. We're going to talk about this day, of course. But we have a relatively inconsequential event, and almost immediately the dialogue reverts to what could go wrong. The U.S. is telling a story of leadership, and it's leadership that, frankly, I think the EU might be a little bit irritated by this particular story. But the point is that U.S. leadership is what has held this together. And the question then becomes, if the U.S. is what held it together, then what happens if the U.S. falls apart? To that point, I think the phrase that I would stick to, since failure is so darn negative, is mind the gaps. Not just the gap to the two-degree trajectory, but the gap in the U.S. INDC that exists between the current trajectory of emissions, which grew in 2014, and the INDC pledge.
The agreement comes open for signature in April of this year, and enters into force if 55 countries that produce at least 55% of greenhouse gas emissions, and they use a string of terms, ratify, accept, approve, or cede, that I think in ways to tread lightly around the T word, treaty. Do you guys, minding the gaps, is there a sense that folks in April are going to be ready to step up and do this? Do you have a feeling that Europe is lined up, and when April hits, behind apparently Fiji, they're going to jump right in?
Well, I mean, the EU has an interest in having this moving forward, a strong one. They are trying to build an energy union, and one of the pillars for this is certainly reviewing the ETS. I think Europe is going to still try to be, the catalyzer and try to get the hopes high.
Well, I mean, Bill, you're someone who's got a lot of hope, and we love you for it. Tell me, is there a sense in wings of the environmental community that this is, too much hat and too little cattle when it comes to, what we need?
The short answer is yes, but I think it was predictable. I think the gaps are predictable. Even I was insinuating that there was success or real success as an opportunity in October, which meant that success was going to be success no matter what. And so if you want to use plain English with that, I mean, I always half anticipated that it would be a success in mediocrity. And in many ways, that's what it is. And what we've pledged to do, which is significant, and I think for the reasons Gene said, I'm going to put a finer point on it and maybe be slightly more caustic, but I think Gene's, we all have, I think I agree with everything you said, even good old Mr. Book I agree with.
I love how I get the even.
Yeah, but we pledge to avert disaster. That's what we essentially as an international, we pledge to not be complete idiots. We did not pledge to fix the problem. We pledged to try to fix the problem. So what we've in essence pledged to do is to continue muddling along with semi-climate chaos, semi-climate misery, until apparently it gets so bad, then we'll really try to fix the problem. And of course, at that point, it might be too late. But I think what the world has done and what the U.S. led us toward was getting out of the troglodyte mode, but clearly now heading us into this medium abyss where the future will unplay. And I think, as we were talking about before the show started, there are a lot of contradictory signals in the world right now about what to do with climate. And that, I think, will eventually, you know, whether Paris is able to influence those other trade winds, to me, will be its ultimate sign of success. And I think that's an open question. I'm not a pure blue optimist when it comes to that question.
The U.S. trumpeted the Clean Power Plan as our mechanism. I mean, to Bill's point, Paris set performance indicators up for the world. People pledged to establish them, to live by them, and so on. But the mechanisms that would get those countries there are still open for discussion. We have some frameworks like in the EU with the ETS and what phase three might look like and so on. But here in the United States, it was the Clean Power Plan, offshoot of the Clean Air Act's mechanism around performance standards for power plants that was trumpeted by the U.S. administration. This is how we were going to get it done. Coming back here on the heels of Paris, we had the D.C. Circuit on February 9th of this year stated the decision in a 5-4 decision, and in doing it in a rather unprecedented way where they stepped in to stay it prior to the D.C. Circuit getting a full bite of the issue. There's been a lot read into that stay. Some people think it was insignificant. Some people think it was quite significant because, from a legal perspective, it was unprecedented. I'm curious, Toby, what are your thoughts in terms of the significance of the stay?
It's sort of like sleeves off a vest. The Clean Power Plan doesn't go into effect, and you have to start doing the SIPs between now and then, and between now and 2022, but the actual interim goals don't start until 2022. So the whole theory was, okay, from here to there, you're going to do the SIPs, you're going to work with your states and things like that.
The Clean Energy Incentive Program, early action.
Yes. Yeah. So that's going to probably be a casualty. But DC Circuit's got it on expedited, you know, oral arguments in June. I would assume that the losing party will seek en bloc. But what was interesting about the stay is it didn't just say, okay, until the DC Circuit rules. It said until cert granted, if petitioners or whomever asked for cert, through final disposition of the case.
And did you read that like a lot of folks did, that there was at least a plurality of the justices that had core questions about the underlying, you know, frameworks that were being used for how it was constructed?
I would say that a majority of the justices had questions, which is why they got a 5-4 decision or a 5-4 order opinion in the stay.
Which is now 4-4.
Which is now 4-4. But it's still there.
Yeah, no, exactly.
So again, things can change, and you know, there's always been legal questions. I think when we met back in October, we talked about, you know, there were certain states out there that were going to just, you know, do basically inside the fence line and hope EPA rejects it so they can go appeal and say, you don't have the authority to go outside of the fence line. Mm-hmm. You don't have the authority to do environmental dispatch, to require renewables and things like that. And we got into a good discussion last time about that. But I think more to the point of this is that I think that it shows that there are some questions that need to be answered. And so that's where we are. And you know, Bill just pointed out we're now at a 4-4 decision, and I wouldn't anticipate 4-4 coming up, because I would assume that there's going to be the vacancy will be filled by the time, you know, certain for either side is granted. But prior to Justice Scalia's death, I think that even though the D.C. Circuit weighed heavily towards Democrats, no appellate judge wants to be, you know, eventually be overruled or you know, on appeal. So I think that would have factored into the psyche of hearing the cases and things like that, but now we don't know.
That's a really, that last point, I mean, all of that I think is sound analysis, but that last point I think is particularly apt, because really, the Chief Justice and Justice Kennedy are the two justices that are in play. Justice Kennedy is presumed to be the one more in play, but I think the Chief Justice is still in play, too, a little bit. And I do think that no matter how you interpret the stay, that the Supreme Court, at the very least, was saying to the D.C. Circuit, you get to judge this on a complete level playing field. Because the way it was, if they had allowed the rule to go forward, there would have been this at least psychological feeling, and I think some legal basis for the idea that this thing's a moving train, you know, these people are trying to stop something that can't be stopped, but the Supreme Court stopped it. So one way to interpret that is telling the D.C. Circuit, you know, all bets are off. You can decide this however you want to decide it. And what I think is most interesting from a timing point of view is, you know, this may not get to en banc at the D.C. Circuit, because it may be, depending on who loses, they want to get right to the Supreme Court this term. You know, soon. So, but the timing of this actually is interesting. But the merits of it, you know, I'll pass on that for right now.
And I see an interesting connection, and we'll talk about the electric power supply, the EPSA case, a little bit more in a second. But I see an interesting connection between the Supreme Court green lighting of FERC's assertion that distribution level resources at all parts of the distribution grid, are legitimate participants if they can competitively participate in the wholesale power markets, and that FERC can, you know, govern the way that they participate in ISOs, RTOs, and so on. If you look at much of the rationale behind the out-of-the-fence line arguments under the Clean Power Plan by EPA, is that those out-of-the-fence line deployments, those types of projects, effectively mitigate leakage. In other words, they effectively mitigate additional marginal units coming online and therefore have alignment with the existing fleet that is needing to seek reductions and so on. What's fascinating is that in many ways the EPSA decision supports that logic, in that saying that all of these various distribution level resources, renewable energy projects, energy efficiency projects, and so on, if they are able to, you know, have that access to the wholesale market to compete in the merit order in the generation stack, whether it's demand response, to compete in ancillary services, capacity markets, things like that. If that's the case, and that access to the wholesale market is there, one might argue that it strengthens EPA's argument that those resources outside the fence line are indeed effective leakage mitigation mechanisms, that they really can impact merit order and decisions, and bring some alignment in with the existing fleet that is becoming regulated through the Clean Power Plan.
I'm very curious what others think about that, particularly Toby and Kevin, and I agree with that presumption, Chris. And the reason why is because under the Clean Power Plan, the states just have so much flexibility. They can choose to do whatever they want to get to that goal. So I think that fits within that motif. So I'm very curious, you know, what the other side of that or other sides of that argument are.
The connectedness of the electric grid has always been the premise on which EPA has based its outside the fence line BSER construct. And it's the same reason why EPA officials have said, we're not going to do a low carbon fuel standard the same way, because it's not as connected. So anything that happens to make the grid more connected to distribution level resources bolsters the connectedness argument. And so I agree with Chris, at least in principle, that it's not as profitable for me, I think, probably to agree with Chris as it is for Chris to have this happen. But this makes it happen. This greens the grid in EPA-mediated CPP world a lot more flexibly and in a way that comports the goals of the program a lot better.
Well, when we're discussing what that future looks like, it does feel like we're a bit back like we were around 2006, 2007, where there's maybe something coming in a federal system. We're not quite sure. Number of states are still moving forward. The federalistic patchwork is continuing. We'll see how it unfolds. But it is interesting that there seems to be an increasing recognition of the integrated nature of those resources. And we've seen folks in the utility sector, leadership out of the Edison Electrical Institute, you know, stepping up and saying that we do see that there is a change happening, and the assets in the grid are beginning to reside at distribution levels, that natural gas, renewable energy, energy storage, energy efficiency are growing, and that there's a growing interest in the utility community to get involved in that and accommodate those resources, be able to have the distribution level grid accommodate them, and also own those resources. And so, Toby, I mean, your view is that this is kind of a part of the wave, right?
But at the same time, we can't forget about the billions of dollars that are currently in the ground.
That's right.
Which is what everybody wants us to forget about. Even our trade association, as great as you say they are, in recognizing the future, we have to take a step back and say, okay, what assets do we have in the ground?
Yeah.
I mean, we have nuclear. We have whether.
What do you mean in the ground?
But we've dealt with stranded costs before.
We have coal plants. We have gas plants.
So existing infrastructure.
Existing infrastructure.
I just want to make sure, because keeping the ground
means.
No.
We're not getting into that debate here.
Now, but stranded costs have been. I mean, those issues have come up in the future, and smart regulators have found out ways to deal with them.
But you don't trade in your car if it's still running well just because.
But there are examples. For example, Germany did so.
And look at their prices. Look at their brownouts. Look at their reliability. There's good and bad about everything. But when you start talking about, oh well, let's move away from what we have that works really well. And I could talk from firsthand experience about what we do in the Carolinas, especially in the Midwest and our service territories, about attracting economic development. They just built the first textile mill, in I don't know how long, in Fort Mill, South Carolina, because of low electricity prices, reliability. People don't want to have to suspend services because they don't have power. And what you've seen in Germany is moving away from coal, away from nuclear, and to more renewables, but it's become less reliable at times.
But don't you think on the long run, there is the possibility that, you know, this is going to be offset in terms of, you know, at a certain point, I think you have to make a decision. And the decision is going to come with some costs. But there is also a social aspect to that. And I think Germans are not, I think they are not completely unreasonable or stupid. And I think they did so doing their calculations. And perhaps doing those calculations, looking more at the long run and less at the short term.
What's the square mileage of Germany?
It's a relatively big country in Europe.
The square kilometer.
But you will say even amongst your existing assets, you guys are already, because of various market conditions and so on, running ever more efficient fleets.
Right, and when we're investing billions of dollars in renewables and. We have you talked about energy storage. Duke Energy has the largest energy storage facility in North America. So it's not that some companies can be accused of burying their heads in the sand and saying, oh, well, it will always have a centralized system. I think most companies recognize the fact that things are getting decentralized. And they're investing in those markets. They're investing in those things. But at the same time, what I'm saying is you can't forget about those hard assets that create the centralized electric grid.
No, indeed. Indeed. And one would argue, as I often do, that there's a tremendous rate-based opportunity for utilities out there to invest a lot of capital in upgrading the distribution system, controls, storage at the substation, to basically accommodate the rise of distribution-level assets, both theirs and others, independent third parties, and that there's a tremendous business model there, basically conducting a future of assets that are massively more flexible, dispatchable, in terms of what they can do than traditional ones.
No question. If you look at utilities, solar, I mean, it's the investment going into utility-scale solar is massive compared to what it was 5 years ago. But the cost curves have come down so much. And what you see in the cost curve of battery storage and things like that, that's coming down the same way it was for solar 5 years ago. So you'll see a lot more investment in that.
Just to, first of all, I want to observe that we're probably the only group to compare CPP and climate renewables policies between the Carolinas and Germany on the air podcast-wise. But to respond to that point,
man, that's bratwurst. That's bratwurst on the beach, man. I love that.
So, there's actually to take that comparison, and in the Midwest, it's actually true in the Midwest as well. You have a high population density, essentially mature economy, where the social compact in Germany was partly to reward the labor side of the equation by creating a lot of jobs. Their renewables dependence was not just a climate choice. And for them, it was a big full employment target choice.
And they are the major manufacturing for solar panels in EU.
And so it worked.
It worked.
But in a much more diffuse, less population-dense area, where there's a lot of rural investment, but also a lot of industrial investment predicated on a different social compact, which was cheap power. I mean, Toby mentions the textile industry. The textile industry got absolutely destroyed by Chinese trade. The fact that it's resurgent probably also reflects higher labor costs, something closer to fair labor costs in China. But it is entirely dependent on cheap inputs for industrial productivity. The labor compact that's being met is to provide for the not just the firms, but the populations that were dependent on this low-cost power. And there's a lot of anxiety about changing that.
You know, very fascinating conversation, and I agree with all of it. And I want to go back to Chris's initial point that sparked it, which is it feels like we're in 2006, 2007. And, you know, at first I sort of rolled my eyes at that. But you're right, Chris. And the big, huge difference is that we finally figured out after 10 years that Congress was close to irrelevant, not worth wasting our time on, basically a mosquito on all of our rear ends. And all of the work in the last 10 years has been done by the agencies, by the executive branch, trying to deal with, I think, the issue Toby best laid out, which is how do we deal with either an aging infrastructure or competing infrastructures or confusion about what the next infrastructure. And that's really what we're discussing. And, of course, the existing power edifice has the advantage in that debate, both as a matter of politics and as a matter of history. And what we've been seeing is, with coal anyway, it took us 8 years to sort of wrest the power away from that, although that's obviously an ongoing, very complex process. And I guess ultimately what I think it all means is that Obama really has been the all-the-above president, with maybe an asterisk against coal, although coal, I think, was meeting its own demise. Because in essence, what I think Obama has said, the signals his administration has sent is, we're going to keep, for the most part when we can, the existing infrastructure, unless it's really decrepit, we want to get rid of it. But we're also going to add new infrastructure on top of it. And that has added some chaos, and I think that is sometimes wasteful. And I do think, as Kara said, eventually we're going to have to choose. But that's not going to be today.
Now, let me ask you this. Is the Clean Power Plan stay more impactful on the international level than it is on the national level? With the Clean Power Plan stayed, does it change the road that a lot of folks are heading down for pure economic reasons?
Could I just address Bill's last comment
briefly? No, pause my question and get back to him. No, that's fine, please.
Bill's point was that there's a lot of entry to the grid, but not a lot of exit. And that's the point my colleague Christy made in a note yesterday, which is that the next glut is really happening on the power grid when you take CPP, which was a catalyst for removing some of the old, and you put some uncertainty or at least some time between now and when that removal takes place. You have a lot of retrofitted coal plants coming back in the next couple of years to run out their 84 months of amortization before they expire and get put out to pasture. So you're going to have coal power coming on the grid at the time that renewables are being fully incentivized for the enduring future. This sounds like glut 2.0, which doesn't make anything easier.
Well, demand is staying fairly flat. And that's the truth. And part of what drove our infrastructure expansion historically was that you could always count on demand going up. And a lot of the dynamics we're seeing now with more megawatts hitting the grid and so on is that one would argue the lines between demand and supply are beginning to blur in some places. I'd like to get back to this question, though, because I've heard from some other folks internationally that they thought the Clean Power Plan stay was a massive, massive impact, and that it was, you know, that it seemed to be a number of folks internationally were really looking at it as this substantial thing. I've talked to a lot of folks here who, you know, as we've talked about before on this show, take the view that, you know, with utility MACT, with other controls and requirements coming in, with the gas price environment and so on, that the Clean Power Plan in many ways was just one more gust of wind in a storm that was already blowing in that direction. I'm curious if folks do, from an international perspective, has the stay been seen as something that can throw a wrench in the entire mechanism vis-a-vis the U.S. participation?
I mean, I think the U.S. has always had this sort of like, difficulty in really committing internationally. And I think, in this particular area especially, we saw that with the Kyoto Protocol. But I think the EU is going to do it anyway. They are because they are committed to this, and it's sort of like you cannot really control. And I think this is what's fascinating in this area. You cannot really control what others are doing. Hopefully, you're hoping for the best, and that will sort of like, at a certain point, share their view. The U.S. has always been a lot about, what is the economic consequences of that, and I think the EU has also a lot of problems right now. This is not gonna stop it. And so the importance of what the states are going to do is relative overall from a EU perspective, but it's just what I'm seeing and my opinion.
Well, I think not only the EU nation states, I think the majority of US states are going to keep going.
Oh. Well, I mean, at the moment, 18 are not. Actually, 18 states have suspended operations, and 20 are going forward, and a number are reassessing or are continuing, but are continuing to sue. But internationally, I guess, I think that you're right. You started to touch on what happened after the Kyoto Protocol. And of course, the Clinton administration negotiated the Kyoto Protocol, and there were changes and modifications that were put into it because of things they pushed for. And then the U.S. did not join. And there is the echo of that, I think, in this process. I mean, I don't know what Europe, will do, or what any country will do. But I think it does inject some uncertainty, especially for major developing countries that were sort of brought along in part because the U.S. was really pushing this, China and India. I covered Paris, and at some of those press conferences, especially the Indian negotiators were saying, well, it better not happen again, that the U.S. pushes as much as it does and really pushes developing countries to take a larger role and then walks back its own commitment. And, I don't know if this stay will lead to, the U.S. reneging on what it promised, but it isn't good. It is effective that this is there, and it's creating this uncertainty, I think.
But there is a component of sort of like naming and shaming. At this point, you really put your face. No? You don't agree with that?
No, I think the international community looks and says two out of the three branches of government don't agree with it. Congress doesn't agree with it. Now the courts are questioning it.
Yeah.
So it's only, one part. But these guys have as much power as this guy, so I wouldn't. And back to the point, the U.S. has a fair commitment, I guess.
We're not easily shamed by the international
right,
community.
Exactly.
No, that's not true.
I mean, do you think Jim Inhofe's going to be easily shamed?
Not a snowball's chance.
No, but what did happen to Jim Inhofe?
Not a snowball's chance on the floor is the
that's
new phrase.
Right.
Yeah.
But the shame is growing and growing and
but
growing.
But what did happen, though, in the U.S. post-Paris, and this is a political dynamic we haven't touched upon yet, was that, and I don't think this has changed because all this stay stuff really is, insider pool to most Americans, is that it did marginalize
the naysayers on climate change in the United States. They're what you saw poll after poll after Paris show that even majority of Republicans,
right.
And that was not. So I do think there has been the big boulder has moved.
The flat out
clearly in the direction of we got to do something.
Yeah. Yeah, but Toby, are a lot of people, are you seeing integrative resource plans? And I know you don't often, work at on that operational level, but I've heard a mixed report from utilities over the country. Some people, if they were already starting one, were already kind of tuning it in that direction. Other people said we were going to have to do a new one because we were kind of mid-cycle. And so on.
Well, see, that's difficult. See, those people saying that, I don't understand how they could be saying that because they're still they should be still working with their states.
Yep.
To come up with what that SIP's going to be.
And I guess my question to you is are you, did the stay impact directionally where a lot of folks were heading because of a lot of the other pressures that we're talking about? Toxics, gas pricing, all the rest of it.
I mean, for Duke Energy, it didn't do anything for us. We're still investing where we were investing before. We're still working with our states that want to work with us because some of the states that have said they're not going to move forward are states that we provide electric services in. But for us, low gas prices, tend to make you start building out infrastructure for gas. Renewables, we've been bullish on renewables where North Carolina has an RPS and then we have a commercial arm. So that's investments that we're continuing to make. But for some of the other companies that aren't in those situations, I would say, they were probably against it to begin with. And B, this, for the whole industry, what this does is it throws up that uncertainty. And it's not like our businesses can change on a dime. We put assets in the ground for 30 years, usually minimum 30 years, 25 to 30 years for solar. So we want the certainty and the clarity around what we have to do moving forward, not just economically, but regulatory. Because as a regulated company, profits and investments are regulated. I know Mr. Book wants to say something.
Yeah.
Oh, no. I'm absolutely happy with socialism when it brings the power to the home.
Yeah. Well, the... It's it's interesting. It's going to be, as you pointed out, Toby, quite some time, and we'll have a new Supreme Court. By the time that this actually rises back up to that level, given the nature of the stay, and I think it would be even more unprecedented for the Supreme Court to change its stay than the stay itself was. And so we have some time to see. It's amazing how this uncertainty theme has kind of propagated. And it really is one of the challenges we have going forward. However, in an era of regulatory uncertainty, where we're seeing technology, and overall installed capacity costs for a variety of different resources, variety of different fuels, and so on, continue to head down. I guess, Kevin, from your perspective, is the uncertainty enough to overcome directionally, where folks are heading? Do you foresee any kind of change in, say, the gas commodity price environment that would, impact the tailwinds that folks are seeing here that the Clean Power Plan was adding to?
Oh, let's see. If I go back in history, gas prices fall to below $2, NGCC gets overbuilt, and then rise again.
Yes, and then a lot of banks own a lot of plants. Yes, we know.
So I don't actually expect gas prices to rise significantly, if significantly is measured in percentages under 50. But they could rise by 50% over the next 5 years. And that's not, at the margin, a big difference when you compare the delivered costs in the past. But in a time when coal prices are falling because of oversupply, it does create, at the margin, some headwinds. On the other hand, renewables prices are falling. The uncertainties on renewables have a lot more to do with the durability of the compensation framework, with essentially the tariff structure in the states where they're being attached to the grid. Right now, it still looks like most everybody likes the renewables, but there's starting to be some net metering reconsideration, which makes some of the solar questions less cut and dry. Most of the wedge, though, is really going to come from wind anyway. So we're really talking in practical terms about a small part
of uncertainty in a small part of the overall spectrum. So no, I think things will probably more or less continue apace. The one uncertainty you didn't mention is the uncertainty that comes with the chief executive. I suppose that now that Trump is the front runner and no one believes he can win the election, people have decided there's no risk of a Republican president. But let's never say never, at least not this election cycle.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I, the only pushback I wanted to give you on the net metering issues, you're right, that is a dynamic in some states, but it's a dynamic being driven 100% by fossil fuel mining in specific industries and specific political actors who want to see it go down. It has nothing to do with some political groundswell of discontent. It is a
disenfranchised grannies.
It is a hatchet.
Solar panels,
no, it's a hatchet job going on.
Are you telling me this is AstroTurf?
Are you telling me neighbors subsidizing others with rooftop solar?
Alec, I mean, look at what the Koch brothers and Alec are doing in Florida. It is a hatchet job. And it has nothing to do with the political will of the people wanting to have that metering, or and same things happening in Arizona.
Well, and
I want to make a larger point. That was just a pushback on a click.
I want to pick up
the hatchet for a second.
Well, maybe we should do that then. I just think it's true, and I think eventually at the state PUC levels, assuming that there is sunshine on this and we do have a chance to fight fair, I think within 5 years you're going to see most state public utility commissions and regulatory bodies of their ilk. I think you are going to see a massive change in how it is they do. You're already seeing it. And I think that's going to happen toward renewables and toward clean energy, irrespective of the Clean Power Plan, although I agree the Clean Power Plan would move it along more quickly.
Yeah, and the net metering debate has gotten awfully polarized. And there's,
it's ridiculous, you know, on some
on one hand, you know, the rate class allocating arguments and so on do have some purchase, but have been taken, in many cases, to a polarized point. At the same time, the solar advocates, are also polarized because there are impacts, you know, to the grid. There are impacts to rate structure and how, you know, costs are being distributed and shared, and so on. I would argue what is often not understood in the debate is the distributional value of that solar, you know, to the grid, and that as grid systems, distribution networks get more sophisticated, utilities invest in more controls and technology, the value of D, as it were, will grow and have some significance. It might be in some cases that it's not that solar is not mature enough, it's that the distribution grid it sits in is not mature enough to take advantage of it. So that, to me, breeds tremendous opportunity for, you know, distributional utilities to make a lot of investment.
Just for the record, I'm nodding.
Kevin's nodding. That could, and for the record, that makes me feel a lot better. Well, Toby does. I mean,
if you want to be off the grid, then cut the line to your house. Period.
But what?
Period. If people want to say, oh, well, you need rooftop solar and you'll be off the grid, and then cut the line to your house.
See, we're seeing an entrenched industry
react. No, it's not. I think that solar advocates would do themselves a justice of saying, okay, we're going to sell the power back at wholesale prices like a utility has to buy from everywhere else, as opposed to full residential prices.
There's a middle ground.
Yeah, I think that's a
problem. Yeah, and that's what I'm getting at.
And I think
the debate's polarized, and there is a middle ground.
The utility industry would be in a lot better position of accepting something like that, as opposed to, oh, well, you want to send money back and get credit. You want us to pay for full residential prices and give you credit, which means that you're not paying for any of the infrastructure.
I can agree with that. I'm not saying I would agree with how we would decide it, but that pivot of a question is reasonable. I agree with that.
Yep.
I get that. Because we have probably a few more minutes, maybe 5-10, I wanted to just throw out this one thing on the Supreme Court decision that I think that we're missing, and I'm going to nerd out just for a minute or so, which is that in many ways this stay is a lot like American University beating Maryland in basketball at halftime. I mean, okay, it piques your interest, but there's no way AU is going to beat the Terps when the time the game is over. And I do think that the Chief Justice, he is the most political Chief Justice I have seen, and he's a smart political Chief Justice. We saw it in the healthcare decision. And I think that we have to remember with the Clean Power Plan that before the Chief Justice died, he and the Chief Justice were fighting about administrative law. They've been having a series of decisions when they're on opposite sides of the decision about what deference agencies should get. And
to make a long story short, it does not appear as though the Chief Justice likes Chevron. He does not agree with its framework. He's been itching to go after that framework. And I think he may, in the Clean Power Plan, have an opportunity to have his cake and eat it too. I believe it is plausible. I'm not saying that this will happen, although I'm obviously hopeful it will on some level, that by giving the stay, we have that level playing ground that I already discussed. That means no one has the perceived advantage going into oral argument. You can withstand, in my view, Clean Power Plan can withstand judicial scrutiny even under a scrutinizing standard. I believe it gives so much state flexibility, is so well within the bounds of Section 111, that I don't even think you need that much agency deference to allow this rule to go forward. And I think the Chief Justice could manipulate that type of event. He could take a pot shot at Chevron, which he's itching to do, uphold a plan that basically has massive societal support. The only ones who don't support it really are on the margins politically, fighting their old economic death, you know, in terms of trying to prevent it or elongate it as much as they can. And I think that's a plausible scenario. And
While we're nerding out, I mean, do you foresee him trying to substantially restrict Chevron step two, or do you think that he's going to just try to hold a tighter gate at step one?
I don't know, but I think what I've read from that one, I think it's the Arlington decision from a few years ago where the Scalia, Roberts split really reared itself. I think he wants to question the whole notion of when an agency gets deference in the first place and not have it be so religiously tied to the words of the statute. I think he's trying to look at the intent of the statute and the intent of Congress as well. And that raises some serious issues about how much he would want EPA to just go out on its own and get deference just because the Clean Air Act allowed it to. Because remember, he was on dissent on Massachusetts versus EPA. So in some ways, you look at it through that lens, woo, EPA's in trouble. But when you actually read the rule, which we all have to some extent or another, you realize that the states get an answer for every potential problem they will have. This is not a command and control regulation. This is a framework regulation, and I think it is well within the bounds of the Clean Air Act to push gently in the way that the Clean Power Plan does. And I think it's really plausible that certainly now with Scalia's death, I don't see how Kennedy would vote against it. I don't see how Kennedy could vote for Massachusetts versus EPA, say the agency needs to do something, and then throw out the very plan that has been the result of 8 years of compromise. It'd be absurd for Kennedy to take that position. So I think we're at 5-3 no matter what right now. And I'm laying the framework that the Supreme Court may not only support the Clean Power Plan, may actually put an exclamation point on it.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about, you know, picking up the mantle of intent, and as someone who's spent time on the Hill, and I told you, you're in this camp too, and you've been involved in the sausage making, it's hard to put a great amount of stake to say, you know, this speech, that chairman's report, this or that, you know, to frame intent outside the text of the law.
Is this Chris Behrendt originalist? Is that where we're starting?
No, just Chris Behrendt, who's experienced the sausage making process. It's very hard during that process to pick a point of it where you can kind of crystallize intent, and it's arguably intent crystallizes in the text, but the text does have to be taken account in the circumstance it is. I'm kind of Jeffersonian in believing in that.
So you have 23-year-olds saying, okay, I'm going to get this report language in. That's non-binding.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. That's
okay, that's a little different from disparate versions of Section 111 and some of the other...
Not talking about like conflicting statutes.
Statutes, yeah. Yeah.
Well, there are disparate versions of 111, just so we're clear on that. I mean, it's like a comma. It's not, but constitutionally, the House version and the Senate version were different. And again, that's another reason why the Supreme Court gave a stay. Like, that's a classic Supreme Court issue.
Yep.
The House version and the Senate version of the bill have a clause that's different, and it's still law. I mean, that's a problem in and of itself.
That's what the court is for.
Yeah. So.
Well, it's... I hate to beginning to wrap up shows with uncertainty, but that does seem to be a theme. There is uncertainty on how the Clean Power Plan stay will play internationally. There's uncertainty on who's going to pony up to the table starting April to sign and ratify under the Paris Treaty. Other mechanisms where folks have talked about, well, we maybe have a, you know, Section 115 fallback and things like that. Well, you know, that would be great, but the treaty's not binding. It's not a treaty. Agreement.
Yeah, but that hasn't even been tested.
And that's never been tested or touched, and so more uncertainty. I think we can agree Kevin, Toby, Bill, all of us, that when it comes to issues of the electricity grid transforming and things like net metering and so on, that there is probably a smarter, more moderate position than we're seeing in a lot of the debates now. But the overall circumstance we are finding ourselves in feels an awful lot like back in 2006, 2007. And I hate to say that because, at least from my own personal experience working with entities in the power sector, of all stripes, the one thing everybody would like to have is some damn certainty to understand where things are going. The Clean Power Plan seemed to offer some of that, at least if it was going to stand legal muster. But now we have what, at 4 years? I mean, what's the 4 years, 3 years before we really know what it's going to look like and play out? Even if it gets green-lighted through Supreme Court review on a frameworks basis, then there's going to be a ton of challenges where people are going to try to push the bounds on how they design their SIP. You've got a variety of states who feel about it differently. Some states are going to try to make SIPs that work at the cracks of the Clean Power Plan legally. Other states are going to try to make SIPs that try to promote EPA's legal arguments on how the Clean Power Plan is developed. But the one thing that is assured is less certainty. It's funny that in many ways, contrary to what we've experienced in the past around things like gas commodity pricing and installed technology costs and so on, that prospectively some of the most certain, the things that we can be certain on going forward appear to be things like commodity pricing, installed technology costs, and so on. I know Kevin's giving this questionable look because I know he loves volatility, but it does seem that going forward, a lot of the things that were traditional volatility aspects in the power sector are evening out, and that we might draw certainty from those. I mean, what are your thoughts, Kevin?
Chris, the thing that troubles me most is the flat demand scenario. I still look back to the 1990s in California's utility planning process and the severe mistake they made extrapolating from an anemic time in economic growth and finding themselves on the short side in the next decade. Are we really structurally different as an economy? Is it already the point where we've cycled so much efficiency into the mix? No. It is too soon for that kind of wholesale change. This is a behavioral change, and it may be an enduring behavioral change, but it is not a structural change yet. Structure may yet overtake the behavioral, but it might not. And so I think we're yet to see whether or not volatility can come back with a demand spike. I don't know where that demand comes from right now. It's not coming from the burger flipping jobs. It's not coming from the millennials taking Uber. But it might yet come. So I'm not sure we're done with volatility just yet.
Any last words from the team? I mean, from our international colleague here, I've heard many times from the EU and others that there's a sense that the U.S. At some point will take an approach to dig into this and that our leadership will materialize in a more substantive way. I'll let you have the last word. Do you think that there is still hope that that's going to happen, or is all the uncertainty that we're talking about pretty much built a real politique picture that this is going to continue to look like we've seen international climate efforts in the past?
I think that, the EU, uncertainty is right now everywhere. The EU is also seeing a lot of uncertainty, and certainly while the EU committed as a bloc, each country is also sort of like in a different stage. And, with the economic downturn, with the migration crisis, I think it's not just, I think uncertainty is the new sort of like, status that worldwide we are going to have to deal with. But I think ultimately, because the EU is extremely committed to, and has already a legal framework in place, it's not that it's coming April they're gonna like take a different attitude. I think it's irrespective to what other countries are going to do. I don't think the EU will never sort of like back off on that respect.
Doesn't the EU have to pass some, which it's expected to do, but pass some domestic legislation in order to? I've heard that it's not actually certain that this year they'll be signing the agreement because they have to pass some legislation to support their 40% reduction target.
So the one of the tools through which this is going to happen is the ETS, which is the main directive that deals with trading carbon emissions. But you have to distinguish what's happened at EU level and what's happened domestically. So at EU level, the EU is doing this as a one block. And so then how you're going to implement the Paris Agreement is going to depend on each country's decision. So it has always worked like that, and there isn't really a barrier in terms of ratifying Paris.
Huh. That's interesting.
Well, I loved Kiara's conclusion that the only thing we're certain about is uncertainty. That's like a new FDR line lurking there somewhere. But I'll just say that we laughed about it. Well, I didn't laugh. Toby laughed. I smiled without showing my teeth. This Keep It in the Ground movement in the United States is interesting in that it has enjoyed a couple early successes. It actually is now not only an effective campaign, but it has been legitimate. I mean, a year ago, no one was talking about it, and now we are talking about it. And if this movement really does take on globally with local citizens in areas where they are able to do this in countries, it is a new political force, because it really gets at, no, we don't want to accept because we don't want to burn it eventually. And I think particularly on American public lands and in other sensitive places, not only in this country but around the world, that just restricting the amount of supply, you're never going to keep all the Jack-in-the-Box lids on. But the fact that some of them are going to stay on, I think, is a significant development and something that will add to uncertainty.
Could we tease that for next session?
I think we could tease that, because I suspect Kevin's going to say something like, if you leave it in the ground here, it's just going to have more come out over here.
What's
going to use for baseload?
To be continued.
To be continued. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us in the heat. We'll see you next time on the Hot Air Show.